I'm talking to Jim Nolan. Jim, tell me a little bit about your background. Where do you come from and where did you grow up?
I was born on a small farm in North Roscommon, the parish of Ardkern, and it's famous for the Rockingham Estate and other things as well, and north of Boyle, historic town, and going back to the 12th century, and 10 miles north of Boyle and 10 miles north of Carrigan-Shannon. So we went to school, the local school there. The Irish teacher there was Master Kelly. He was keen on Irish, learning Irish. We did the school through the medium of Irish, which I always liked, and I got to like it better coming down here. I worked with a cross-border project called Cahal, Bui, Magilla, Gona, a few counties, Cavan, Fermanagh.
And how long ago was that?
That'd be about in the early noughties, yeah. So,
what was it like doing a project at that time?
Well, it wasn't a project, it was just kind of a conversations with groups from each place. And Jim, my namesake was Jim Nolan, who also does archaeology in Leitrim. I talked about him later. And it's just we would read, sing songs out of books and have just talk some informal Irish, you know, like that, yeah.
And
it was just Jim. Well, I was good. Some of them thought I was good, but I wouldn't be as good as the other Jim, like, you know. Yeah, mm. Yeah.
And then, so after your education, what did you go on to do?
Well, I started working in local jobs with the county council or different around the forestry, and then I started with the ESB and just on the rural electrification, putting up the poles and all that.
So in those early days, putting up electricity poles, this was the first time that electricity was coming into the countryside. You were lighting up the countryside.
That's right. That was in the 50s, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was very exciting. And then, well, country people are conservative, and I'd say the country people rambling, you saw, you know, the way that have come out of the war, and my father kept us all alive with a garden, you know, it was self-sufficient with food and all that, went very little to the shop, and you had the lamp oil, you know, the oil lamp, and then I think the tilly had come on as well, where it progressed a bit, but are you taking the light? Ah, no, too dear, the ground rent and everything, you know, it wouldn't be a great idea.
What was your job? What were you doing?
I was working as a manual worker, putting up the poles first, you know, and then I went on to the stores, and then I went, and just mainly on the lines, you know, just on the lines, and pulling across the wire, cable across the field, setting it up on the poles, and I wasn't too good at the climbing or anything like that. But just a few years like that then, before I went to the station, and, well, I went on into the courses under the, up in Pigeon House in Dublin for operating the turbine, which was making the power. The transmission I started off on, like, you know, yeah.
So you got in at the ground level?
I did at the ground level. I did dig in the hole, yeah, down 6 feet, you know. And putting up the poles and assembling the cross arms and putting the cross part on and fitting the parts, you know, all the parts. Bringing out the transformers and connecting them up, and houses had to be serviced. There'd be men going round with a handcart then for doing just putting up the wire as far as the up over the door, you know, the little drip loop at the door, then run in, and then they'd get some contractor to wire the house, you know.
And were people excited about the fact that...
They were excited, yeah. And then we'd be out in the fields, you know, and somebody would say, that's a good house up there for the tea, you know, and they get the tea. And there was a good old atmosphere about it, you know, it was great.
And did you get refusals, people actually refusing to take electricity?
No, you wouldn't have so much of that when it... There might be very few now. There might be some man who didn't get married, was on his own or something, and he might take it then, maybe grudgingly, and he might put in one bulb. You know, he wouldn't embrace the whole lot, plugs and all that. You know, and then we've moved so far on to that sense. You know, yeah.
Or for the farmer in the country farmyard, putting light into the cow house where they were milking.
Well, my yearly wouldn't be intensive. You know, my father would just have six suckler cows when I started in as well. But a few small farm, you know, six mm-hmm. suckler cows and a few young cattle. It was mostly manual and donkey and cart work. And on the bigger farms then, as it developed, like people became to use it on milking machines and all that, you know, we'd have maybe 80 cows or something like that.
And that's when it took off.
It took off really then. Yeah. It took a little while, like, for it to bed in, and it's, you know, handy to switch on, and you got so used to it. Then, like, the motor car came in around the same time, you know, a lot of all these things.
Group
water schemes then as well. A lot of things followed, you see.
Yeah, because you went to the turbine stations here in Dublin, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to Pigeon House, yeah.
Pigeon House. So you followed the progress of
the electricity generating it, yeah. Through the Parsons turbine was counted the Rolls Royce of turbines, you know, and Germany's would have put in, Siemens Schuckert would have put in the turbine in Arigna, and the Simon Carves company put in the boiler, you know, they would be all experts in their own field, so you'd be working with Germans, you know, and their language, Irish wasn't too good, English wasn't too good with them, you know, it's something was good, it's much good, and Nick's good, it wasn't too good, you know.
But, you know, you were making history.
Yeah, probably didn't realise it, yeah.
Did you not?
No, but probably wouldn't, yeah, just got the... We got a radio, his master's voice, around that time as well, and putting up the area, you know, it was all slow progress, you know, just nice progress, like, you know, there was a man who drawn in the poles with the horses, you know, and all that, you know, delivering the poles for the group, you know, the low tension group. You had high tension lines going on, then you had low tension, you had transformer, and then you had the lines to the house, you know, that was the low tension, yeah.
And the making of those poles, where was the timber coming from?
Mostly Sweden, I think. Sweden, Norway, yeah, they were.
And it was all imported timber then?
It would be, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and then the greasing of the poles.
Yeah, but they were saturated, it was gone through the whole way, maybe just to the very centre, you know, it was. Yeah.
Mm.
And it turned out that I spent 40 years with them, then went on, the generating station was built in Arigna for burning native coal, and Well, at the time, you see, there were a few stations built along the seaboard, down as far as Kerry, Clare and Donegal, you know, and there were 5 megawatt stations on the coast, and this was 15 megawatt for burning coal, which was for to assist the local community and keep it alive. So it went for over 30 years, and then it closed down when the seam was getting too low, you know. So I was then in the end, and it was, well, we were campaigning along with a Father Tynan, a nephew of General Sean McKeown, and a teacher there, and a few other local committee, but we just there was a deal signed to the government and all that, and to give the miners a pension scheme which they hadn't paid into, like, and to get to complete. So it closed down the area, like, it would be taking a million and a quarter out of the area annually, and we
But what was your personal story?
The power station and all that was kind of a difficult time for me, like, as well, you know, because we had about 1,000 people in the Mayflower, Ballroom, and Shamba, like, protest and all that, and then we, but there was a committee as well set up, but I seemed to be targeted, like, because when I was working, if I took a day off, it was only supposed to be 1/7 of your day deducted, like, for 1/7 of a week, and then they started putting in the booth and the dock, started docking 1/5, and then they started taking away the work from me, and then they said, "Right, and to write your letter to see what were you doing," you know.
Okay, so it wasn't an easy place to work.
It wasn't easy once the closing thing started. Well, it was a lovely place to work up to that for 20 years or 25.
Yeah.
But when the closure started, the pressure was on, like, you know, it was.
They tried to get you out.
Well, it must be. They were chipping away at me, like, yeah, they were.
Okay. And so when did you relocate up here to Enniskillen?
Well, they got round the committee then, and the committee resigned in block, I think. They were promised jobs, 7 of them. And then they put me on development around La Halland. Well, I was in the Munchen and Cheer movement and helping start up the credit unions. I had a good history, like, in the community sector. And they appointed me as development around La Halland for a year, helping to get projects going there for La Halland, you know, well, helping the local development, and the Mayflower Ballroom was converted into a community centre, and the projects like that.
And where is that now?
It's about 35 from here. It's in mid Leitrim.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I was in that. And then they decided they'd send me to Lanesborough then, when that run out, you know. So I wasn't happy then, and I was kind of protesting and things like that.
Why were you protesting?
Well, I I don't know why I wasn't content that I was. Well, I didn't get any proper job. I was only just maybe messing around a computer. I didn't get any proper job there, you know, in Lanesborough, because the Rigna had closed and then had done the development, and I wasn't content anyway, and I went on a little bit of a fast for 72 hours, and I was brought in on discipline for that then, you know, so that brought it to a head.
That was your protest to go on hunger strike.
There was an end to it, like it was to finish. Well, I think the manager sent down someone then, and about when I was 2 days there, you know, they said to call it off or something. So then I think I was disciplined for that. Then they went to go and discipline hearing and all that. So after that, then I said I'd
roughly tell me the year. What year was that?
I was in Lanesborough I was on the development maybe 91, 92, 93. That was 94 or 95, yeah. Mid 90s. Yeah. So then I worked in Lanesborough for a year or two then, and I came down here. I got working with Enniskillen together. I just decided, well, I had been commissioned as an officer in the FCA as well in the late 50s. I did 31 years as an officer, and then when the troubles broke out, they put three battalions on the border here, one at 27th in Dundalk, 28th in Donegal, and 27th in Dundalk, 28th Donegal, and then 29 in Cavan Monaghan, yeah. So I became part of that as well. We were doing active service, looking on the border duties as well, which was a serious time after the... Well, after the, well, you'd remember Bombay Street, and you remember the Operation Motorman and all, Burntulla and all the serious incidents that happened around that time. The government decided, and then there was another group with Neil Blaney and Kevin Boland. They wanted to do a different thing, but I think that the man who kind of steered us through that part was Jack Lynch, and he didn't ever got enough credit for it, like, you know. So we would have, you know, there would be serious patrols and all that. And
so you saw a lot of
violence.
I
wouldn't have seen the violence, but you'd be just in a, you'd be doing hourly officer or duty officer, and you'd be in an office, and then you'd be just on the first night I was on, James McGinn was coming across the border at Kentlady Bridge up in North Donegal, and he had a bomb in a pram and he got blown up, you know, so that was my first experience. And then he, strange enough, he hasn't been remembered when they have a march in Castle Derg later on. He's remembered, other Republicans are remembered, you know, but he hasn't been mentioned.
What's his name again?
James McGinn.
And where was he from?
He was from that area, up near Castle Derg.
And he was carrying a bomb?
He was carrying a bomb across the bridge. Now, the local folklore is that there was a band playing the other side and the amplification upset it. So that's not proven scientifically, but it's thought that it upset the bombs were fairly finely tuned at that time by the people who were making them up, and it went up anyway. So it was up later, 30 years later, to see the plaque on the bridge, like, you know.
Yeah.
Then the Mountjoy helicopter was another night. We'd have patrols out for that as well. You know, these were a couple of the incidents, but there were incidents and... Fly over at the border then as well. You have to get through to Peter Barry, Minister of Foreign Affairs, if there was a flyover across the border. Just different incidents were being monitored, you know, and all
so
that.
So you were doing police work, really?
It was aid to civil power, like, yeah, to be called, yeah. ACP, yeah.
And so did you encounter any
Well, I wouldn't be face-to-face with it, you know, be just in the barracks, you know. But it was I wouldn't be face to face with James McGinn or anyone like that. But it was all part of, and we would have patrols out at Castle Finn and all that. They would have headquarters at Finner Camp, and there were companies in Rockhill House and Letterkenny and in Castle and in Lifford along at the border, two companies there as well. You know?
Okay, and so can you recall those days? How severe was the threat? You know, was a civil war, because that's
well, what it was. Well, I suppose you'd be younger there. That, I mean, you just took it as it was. You didn't think about it that seriously, but you realised that it was necessary, like all that was all being done. But I would have done the training camp. I was in charge of the training camp in 88, just for our own battalion, you know, up in Fort Dunry. That's in, you know, it's up in Inishowen. It's more northerly than the rest of Northern Ireland.
But this was different than
this
than,
was different.
Regular
camp.
Work.
It was. Yeah. It was. Yeah.
You were FCA, which was
we were, but we were under military law. We were the same as the regular for doing those projects, you know.
I see. Yeah. I see. And how did you feel your own politics? Were you a Republican, or how did you see yourself?
No, my father was a captain in the old IRA, and my uncle was a member as well in the local company in North Roscommon Brigade. But I just joined the FCA and I liked it, and I kind of just liked that whole atmosphere. I never got caught up in this republicanism like at all. No, never. I would be. My father wouldn't have supported any of the Civil War parties either. My father would support Clonpublic and Clontarf and the Farmers' Party and smaller parties, and then I would have tended maybe to go towards Labour then, and got friendly with Dick Spring, like, as well, like, through that, you know. And that would be, I wouldn't be saying, you know, you have to come down and do something about the North or get guns or something like that. Just, you know, I just would see it in a different, you know, from an order point of view, you know.
Yeah. So when you were here on the border, were you did you say that were you back and forth, or
I was fairly popular with the people. You made regular, and you'd have a shift of people coming. You know, you have the helicopter driver would come for a week, and you'd have the bomb disposal man. We call them the bomb. There'd be different people. You'd be in a team of about five or six people who are kind of running the place at that particular shift you're on, 24-hour. You'd start at 9 in the morning and finish at 9. You'd probably be aware of that. You did 24-hour shifts, you know.
So and
And you'd make a lot of friends.
Yes, of course. And what particular place were you at that time?
Finner was the headquarters for the battalion.
Where is Finner now?
Oh, you wouldn't know that. Also famous to the British Army barracks during they were here in power. And then I think Padraig O'Donnell was imprisoned there at some stage when he was a great revolutionary Sinn Féin man, you know, in the 30s. And at one stage then, before things came out, they would come to the holiday home, a little holiday camp for young lads going away at 17 and getting a few pounds and going up on door and getting in with the girls, you know. Here in Finnery, you know, you're getting £20 at the end of the fortnight, and you have the crack in Bundoran, and that was Finnery at that stage. But then it became serious, and so it's only tin huts, but they built a proper barracks, built a stonework. Well, it's just only 3 miles. Two miles past Ballyshannon, halfway between Ballyshannon and Bundoran, a very serious, important place. Like,
and what happened there? So,
it was a military post originally, and then taken over by our own army. And they would have summer camps. They would have hundreds of different battalions coming in from Tullamore, and see, you would have serious training, like, all right. But as people got older and that, and then it became. When the troubles got serious, then with the mostly after the was it Bloody Sunday or whichever the Burn Tullet and all those, and Burn Tullet Bridge and the battened them, Jerry Fate and those are battened, you know, those, and Bombay Street and you know, the serious incident that happened, and Operation Motorman, all these, it was. The people from the bog side, we were looking after the people from the bog side, then they had to come down. They were living there for a number of weeks or months between there and Carnarvon and Carrick and Shannon. So they were staying in the billets. People were put out of their houses, you know, so that was fairly important. But so northern people sometimes, I met some man from Strabane one night, and I said we were looking after the people from the bog side. And sure, if you didn't do it, someone would do it. People can be difficult, you know. In the peace process, when Enniskillen Together was set up after the bomb had gone off here.
But I
was actually on duty. I was at it was called Operation Mallard. I was actually on duty in Finner the day it went off. You know, I was
in Finner,
about 30 miles away. Yeah, but it didn't affect. But like, it was sending out patrols and all that. You know.
Right, but what was going through your mind when that bomb here went off in Enniskillen?
Well, I suppose you'd be disappointed, or you just, you know, you'd be shocked. It's just hard to know your emotions completely, you know.
Of course.
And I was still working with ESB back maybe the following week then as well, you know. I think it was only in on part-time that time, you know. Whenever they'd want somebody, it was, they'd have people going on courses or something, they'd ring you up and say, come in for the night or something like that, you know. But I was fairly well known, like, there, you know, fairly, yeah.
Yeah, and so what happened after that then, when the bomb went off here in Enniskillen and then you were down there?
Well,
what was going on then after?
Well, I suppose it was. I wasn't there as constant, I think, at that time. Afterwards, then there, like for the Bogside people and all that, and then that was 87. I was then I retired then in 1991. It was normal policing and normal army, you know. But everybody was like it was, especially with Mr. Wilson, you know. There was a terrible sense of shock in the whole country, like, you know, both the daughter and all getting killed, you know. And in the barracks, things would be kind of normal, you know.
Yeah.
You do what you're doing all the time.
And in the 1980s, where were you actually living at the time?
We lived in a thatched house. We moved in 66 just to the different parish of Kilrone, and I got a place there, and we moved with my parents down there. We moved 4 or 5 miles.
Yeah.
But something that come out at me, that could collect me, sometimes they leave me home in the helicopter, you know, as well, if my car wasn't working, you know.
So you were living at home at that time?
I was. And the neighbours, some of them be a bit jealous, or be very Republican, say, God, he settled in the neighbour's field in front of the drift. He landed, you know. God, if I was outside, I'd have stopped him landing there. I wouldn't let him land there, you know, with the helicopter.
That's gas. And so, did you continue? Did you ever get married?
I didn't. No, that. Didn't.
Okay, so you were living at home.
And
you were working. Were doing your duties.
As well. Yeah. Aye, that's right. Aye.
In Donegal.
Aye, that's true. I didn't get around to that.
Yeah. Go ahead. Go on.
But
you didn't get around to getting married.
Yeah, not yet. Anyway,
That was a full life, or you know.
Right. But then they said, "Oh yeah, the when you're at the station manager then, and he says, oh yeah, we'll give you a few months and pay your way down here." That was the change.
So you were still with the ESB.
It's the ESB, and I came in here still with the
and
ESB.
And you were with the FCA at the same time.
Oh, I was. Both.
And you were doing the two jobs.
I was.
And you were being flown home by helicopter on the weekends.
But that was only once or twice, you know, coming out to incidents, yeah. I know. Once a lad collected me with his car, jeep one day, and he was killed later in Lebanon, about a few months later, a lad from Sligo collected me, you know. But that's part of it as well, you know.
Yeah, and then your peace work along the border, can you... did that take?
Well, I actually joined Enniskillen together before I left Lanesborough. When I was doing the development work in La Halland, I got the connection now. I came into Belcoo and I saw something. Just see how it registered. I saw a notice in the paper, I'm meeting Enniskillen about Enniskillen together. I said, that's interesting. And then I came in and I joined that. And after a while then, we were talking about doing the setup. To set up a churches group, bringing the churches together, and then there were different kind of training courses and things like that, and meetings in Belfast, and they put me on the management committee then, but it didn't achieve much. It might have got a population of 15,000 here. It might have got 100 people to join it, like, you know, and you know, people. It kind of faded out then, but the churches. Forum after a number of years, after about 10 years, the church forum kind of formalizes itself, and it's the main peace movement here now. So I'd be very active in that, like, as well.
But you were in at the very beginning.
I was in at the beginning, I was, yeah.
And how difficult a challenge was it?
It was to be difficult enough, you know, people in Northern. People had. I was only 40 miles from here to my house. They would say, "Oh, you're from the south. You're a Free Stater." You know that, but that has kind of stopped now. The last 20 years, you're from the Free State. Yeah, your accent. Yeah, and my accent hasn't changed. And then some say you have a lovely accent. I don't know. I have an accent myself at all. You know.
Yeah. And being a nationalist,
I wouldn't talk about the army side of it, like, down here at all. Yeah. You know, because I had my namesake Jim Nolan, and I showed this my uniform there with my commandant markings there. And you know, he said, if anyone sees that, you could be shot. You know, he wasn't very sympathetic, you know.
And how insecure did you feel living in Enniskillen at that stage?
Well, I never felt insecure, no. No, I never felt insecure.
Did you not?
No.
Or did you feel that your Protestant neighbour, how were you, you know, were you coping or getting on, or was there any difficulty?
Oh, yeah, well, I would have got involved, Protestant lady. We were trying to get a Bill of Rights going, you know, and she would talk to me about the church. You know, I don't understand this, the Eucharist, you know, and all this about the transubstantiation and the holy water, and you know, we could discuss that, and I'm very good friends, you know.
Yeah.
What's the holy water about, you know?
So there was no intimidation or any kind of animosity towards you.
No,
ever.
No, but I didn't.
What part of Enniskillen were you living in? Were you living in?
That's the Temple Road. I was close to that. I was just up in Chandra Hill, kind of that area, all Chandra Hill. And then when I moved out, I met a lady who had a bungalow out at Mullock Dun, about 10 miles from here, as you go towards Balco. And they had a nice bungalow, and they had a son in America, thought he wouldn't come back, but he came back then. And then I met a nice man who was a builder, John Boyle. I'm in the house 10 or 12 years now, his house on that road, you know. But I would have got good relations. I would never have any disagreements with people on religion or politics here.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have, you know. No. I wouldn't have. So, well, let me friendly. I'm a bus driver. Oh, yeah. You were the Irish Army. They didn't know whether you were three star private or what. Well, you were just the Army. You know, and with a lot of people, Army would have a lot of bad connotations, you know, in this part. But the Royal Irish Regiment were based out the road. There's a barracks off the road. I didn't realise it could be there, and it's such a kind of a rural place going out there to west of the town.
Yeah. So a big part of your life, anyway, was trying to house people and look after people who were from the bog side down in Donegal.
But that was just a few months, you know. That was a few months job.
But
it was military job then. After that, you know, after that military, just strictly military then, you know.
Yeah,
and went back to the bog side, settled down. Yeah.
Yeah, and so. But I'm trying to get my head around this now. Sorry,
yeah.
When you were controlling the border. Tell me all the. Did you control a big area, or were you just in one particular area?
Well, the 28th Battalion had a functional area, and we'd have a checkpoint at Black Lion, and we'd send out our guard there, an NCO, and maybe six privates, and they would stay in the building there. It's a tourist office now, and we'd have another one at Clyhore, just out the edge of Baleek, where there is there's part of the Shannon scheme, the Shannon. The Shannon scheme and the Erin scheme. There was a Protestant man, he was editor of the paper here, and I used to meet him. I stayed with a Protestant couple out near Evanstown, and he used to like to chat to me about, he was talking about the Clogher Valley and the Erin scheme and the Shannon scheme, and he was a wonderful man, like, you know. And we had great friends with him. He only died a few years ago, yeah.
One from that part of the border then, so where else were there checkpoints?
Well, there would be at Lifford as well, you know, up the county. I was based mostly south Donegal, but I did some time in maybe a week up in Rock Hill House, but it's something else now.
But the majority of your time is around Blackline and
South Donegal, kind of. And the border with Leitrim, and the border with Fermanagh, yeah.
Okay, so
That area.
But these were all hot spots, you know.
There was a lot of
activity.
There was. But on the funny side of it, counted funny, somebody had a few drinks in the pub in Ballyshan that night and said, we're going to brew up the bridge tonight. They might give you a call, you know, but a small bit of that went on as well, you know, just to take a lift out of here, you know.
And would the bridge be?
I just some old bollocks is up there, we'll ring them up and get them out, you know. That would be part of it.
All right. And
in the serious time, you know. Toward.
Apart from yourselves, you had the Garda, Shikana?
The Garda. Well, the Garda is the supreme. Like, we raided the superintendent was the boss. There was a superintendent there called Don Murray. Like, he was, everything went through him, like, you know.
All right. And
the raid to the civil power.
And then you had yourselves there.
We had our own chain of command, yeah.
Well, and then did you have the Irish Army were there too, were they?
Well, we were part of that. We're all the one at that stage.
Oh, were you?
We were all the one. There was no distinction, you know, whether you were FCA or not, no.
Okay, so if you saw somebody coming towards you, and you would you shoot him? Was that your...
Well, there's about six times you can fire a shot, you know.
Yeah.
And you didn't do any army service yourself, did you?
No, I didn't,
Well,
no.
You can fire in defence of your own life, in defence of your comrade's life, in defence of the post you're guarding, defensive government property within view, and in the case of being forcibly disarmed. It's five or six, you know.
Okay, did you ever have to
I never had to call on someone to halt or anything. No, I didn't have anything like that. But just on the radio, like just the road up at the bridge and the like of that kind of way, you know, James McGinn or things like that, you know. Right.
Yeah. But there were lots of people dying, getting killed on
the
other side.
There were. Well, the flashpoints would be up at Castle Finn, Belfast, the northern people call it Castle Fun, you know, the northern accents. There was a UDR man in Bleak that was only a few miles across from where we were, a couple of miles. He was shot out there at Bleak on Sunday evening, you know, but there was no real police or troops around, and he was going to see a girl. And then I was out there just socially going somewhere, and I said, I was very sad about that man was shot going to see the girl. Oh, he was warned, they said. The girl said to me. So that was
How did you see that? Because there was a lot of subversives crossing over and back, you know.
There were. Well, that would be the guards. We wouldn't be in touch with...
I'm talking about the IRA now. They would be over and back.
They would, yeah.
And did you know about that? Did you know that these guys were coming back and forth?
You would. I suppose they'd be... You'd be kind of aware, but you just do your own job. And
was there a kind of free passage? I mean, did they freely go back and forth?
They would, but they'd probably work on unapproved roads and at night time, you know, the people who would be going on that. And it was unapproved roads, you know, all around the border area.
And was there any effort made to deter those?
No, we would be... Our mission was to put our own post and looking after military, the power station. We'd guard in the power station as well at one stage, at Rigna and the Ballyshannon station. Vital installations. That was one, and Trustmore transmitter.
Yeah.
They were our thing. We weren't supposed to look after subversives, or that's the police job. You know, we were aid to that. You know. But our number one was vital installations.
Yeah. Did you think, Jim? Your own, your just personal point of view now. Did you think that that maybe more could have been done to prevent the movement of IRA back and forth over the border?
Well, I there's a lot of people in higher positions than me. I couldn't... people, when I go down the library, people say to me that the IRA had the support of nearly 100% of the civilian population here, you know, and had the support of maybe a lower percentage back where I came from. So you didn't talk about it that much. And neighbours, when I'd go home, they'd be giving out about Cardinal Daly, you know, what he said, you know, things like that. And I wouldn't have had, number one particular question, I wouldn't have any contact directly with them, you see.
Oh, I know that, but
that's the guard's job.
Yeah.
But... The civilian population would be, say they're great lads, you know. Kind of, my father now, you know, he said, you know, he wasn't well off. His generation got married and reared their families, like, you know, and they didn't have much money. There wasn't much money, like, and he wouldn't agree with it, like I do, you know. And I wouldn't agree with what they were doing, you know, the
IRA,
yeah.
Or they were called the provos. They were called
provisional. Aye, yeah, that's right. Yeah, aye. But those words would seldom be mentioned, you know, or that can, people would be getting information from people. There was some man in the army there, and one of the officers would be chatting to him, and he sells coal in the town of Ballyshannon, and he might. I might have overheard them giving, there'd be certain conversation going on with them, like, you know.
About what?
About local people, their movements or something like that. That's the closest I'd get to it, you know.
I see. And that information would be passed on?
Across
the border?
Well, it'd be passed on to the higher command or whoever to be, or to the Gardaí, you know.
Oh, to the Gardaí?
The Gardaí, yeah. We had to go directly to the Gardaí, or we had a secret phone if there was some incident onto our own, a secret phone to ring head. You had to ring headquarters, as everything's all right, every hour or something like that. Yeah. Command headquarters in that loan.
Oh, yeah. But the actual information that was coming from an informer was an informer from what side? You see.
Well, he would be in the army, but he'd be mixing the community, he'd be delivering coal and places, and he'd know.
And getting information.
He'd be getting information, you know, so such a fellow wasn't at home last night, maybe, or something like that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Now I know what you're saying.
Yeah. But I wouldn't be.
You wouldn't be privy
to that. Privy to that, no. Yeah. No. Just, we were just on a professional duty, like, and we were just doing a certain job, and you had to keep your log there, you know, write up your log and answer the phone. It was quite busy, and walking around the barracks at night, you know, and all that, yeah. But the lads, when you'd go up, I'd be patrolling the barracks at Finner, like, and I'd be out, you'd be lovely looking out to the sea and coming up for daylight and all that. And then you come back to the orderly room, might be an officer, an NCO, and the chat was all about Beirut, you know, they were talking about. You know, it wasn't about the IRA at all, yeah. But that was okay too.
Oh, it was, I suppose. But in all that length of time, there was there's 30 years of it.
There was.
So how many years did you spend out of those 30 years on the border? Or not 30?
I was 31 years an officer. I was an NCO before that, yeah. I was 40, I did my 40 years, like, you know, altogether.
That's a long time, giving
it is, you a it service. It is, but just at local level, going round to centres and just maybe giving a lecture on first aid or something like that, or we'd have platoon competitions and drill competitions and drill and dress, you know, but they were just really routine things, you know.
Okay, so are you retired now, Jim? Are you finished with everything, or do you still go around and give talks and...
Well, no, I would have, when we here, I would have joined in a skillet together. It was in that, and then that kind of, the funding stopped from Belfast, and that, and then the Church's Forum was formally done. So the only thing I could see about the, I was on the executive for a year, down there, it tended to be dominated on the executive by Catholic priests. And then when I go to Corrymeela, have you been to Corrymeela?
No.
That's up at Ballycastle. That was started by a man who was involved. He was there in the bombing of Dresden, that dreadful bombing that never should have taken place. He was in prison there, a man called Ray Davey, and he started that in the 60s, and it's developing into a better place now. Mm-hmm. It's a peace centre there, only 9 miles across from Scotland.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah.
Your cross-border projects, can you describe those a little bit more in detail to me?
Well, I came to Enniskillen 2 days ago, 13th of February 1996, 22 years ago, and I had been interested when I was doing the project on Lahallan development. I used to come into Belcoo, and I saw a notice about Enniskillen together, and I got to join that around 92 or 93. The bombing had been on in 87, and in Enniskillen, they had a lot of festivals at the time for the first few years, and then thinking of the bomb and all that working together kind of died down a bit, and maybe about 100 people might have joined Enniskillen together. It brought people together, but the only thing that continued on from the Enniskillen Together project was the Church's Forum was formed some years later with four main churches, Presbyterian, Methodist, Church of Ireland and Catholic, and I got very involved in that from the start, and still am involved in that. And even as far as last night, we have a lot of speakers. We have Johnson McMaster each winter. We'd have a series of six lectures. Johnson was launching his book last night on reformation to be reformed, and excellent, going back to the history of Europe and the 30 Years' Wars and all that, and Martin Luther and his quirks of personality and all that sort of stuff. So we have been doing that all along, and it it wouldn't attract a big amount of the population, but they have a membership and all that. I'm a member from the start of that. That'd be my main activity, the church's forum. And then we tied up with the Meath Peace Group through Eulita and John Clancy, who lived in a place called Parsonstown, Battlestown, in County Meath, and they formed the Meath Peace Group in 1993. So they would have a lot of talks going on in the centre there, attached to the seminary, and people from Belfast, as it went midway between Belfast, and bringing in Sinn Féin people as well before the ceasefires and all that. And they had outstanding lectures.
So can you recall those meetings and lectures? What was your remit? What exactly were you doing?
Well, I was just attending, really. You know, you'd have...
You weren't part of that group, were you?
I would be... Yeah, I became part of it later on. Lord Henry Mount Charles, you'd have a lot of speakers, prominent speakers, you know, as well, over the years. And then they decided, a man called Roy Garland, whose people came from Monaghan, and they were tracing relatives, and he used to write a column in the Irish News on a Monday, and he met with the Clancy's, and they decided to form the Guild of Uriel. And at that stage then, they appointed me on the committee. You know,
what year was that?
That'd be, I can't just remember now, it's 15 years ago, say from now, you know, around that time. And I was on the committee since that.
And so have things moved on, do you think, since then? Or, you know, were those days, it was full of tension and were groups very difficult to come together for, even, you know, was it?
There was a lot of tension, you know. Men turned up who got legs amputated and that kind of dealing with people, and then there was groups that come from West Tyrone as well, and they would be telling their story, and there would be a lot of, we would have met the Sinn Féin people from Meath as well, and there would have been a lot of tension around that time.
Okay.
Yeah, and the core group was we did a lot of work, but principally the Meath people and the Lisburn people and Newry. I was a member along with a good friend of mine, Mary Hamilton, who started an education centre in a place called Tempo, which is 8 miles north of Inniskillen, and a few miles north of that again in a little schoolhouse called Dunneen. And she did great work altogether. I helped her as well. And then they appointed her onto the committee as well. And then we travelled together for a number of years. And she was very much respected and went up to Dublin. Her funding stopped coming from Belfast. And they said, why not go to Foreign Affairs? She went up and she was very well received there. And she did great work with lectures, different politicians speaking in the centre in Dunneen.
And I think the work that was done, that you witnessed being done over the years in trying to bring the communities together, that was something that you played a part in yourself, and you would have seen the progress made.
Well, I was first impressed by Canon John Hayes from Tipperary. He was a chaplain in Wales, and when he came back to Ireland in 1937, he found the people very depressed after the economic war and the civil war, and he set up an organisation called Munch and Achira, People of the Country, you know, bringing together all citizens without discrimination, and that would tie in with North or South, that kind of objective, and getting people to welcome the electricity as well, and group water schemes and doing any kind of activity. We had a parish show in our own parish. Any kind of economic activity that got people working together, and I was at that, and then I got talking to people in Tipperary who started up the credit union. We started one in our own area then, and I helped with ones in Perth to Leitrim and North Roscommon and Sligo as well, to getting them going as well, you know. So that would be
the credit unions in the early days, is it? Yeah.
Yes.
My goodness, yeah. And so that
would be in the 70s,
yeah.
And then I have, since I came down to Inniskillen, John Hume had been up at a festival, and he's photographed saying that the credit union was the most important activity that he engaged in. giving the people confidence and giving them independence for finance and all that, you know. I have his photograph in our book there, the Kilronan.
And what were the logistics of setting that up, Jim, the credit unions?
Credit union, you had to belong to a definite common bond, say a parish or maybe a parish and a half and on the map and all that. And you'd have to start a study group, which would be, you'd be studying the Credit Union Act 1966 and all the legal sides of it. Field officers would come to Dublin to examine you, like, you know.
Yeah. And did you encounter any difficulties in setting it up in those very early days, you know, when you were?
I know, you'd always get people pathetic, you know, and say they wouldn't like their business to be known, but there were no real opposition to that now at all.
Yeah. No. It was a very positive.
It was positive. Well, there would be a certain amount of bad debts in every credit union in Ireland, and some of them down Kildare or somewhere in Limerick, they went a bit off the rails. But it has been one of the best developments in the whole of Ireland. As I say, I started with the Canon Hayes idea, and it was all about cooperation, bringing people together and coming in and working together. But the credit union, I'd agree with John Hume, like, that it's one of the most important community objectives of whatever set up in Ireland. Before that, I think we weren't very good at cooperating together. We didn't have a great history in Ireland in the cooperative movement. And the Jesuits, that was one of their strong points. They pushed it. I had some meetings with the Jesuits in Dublin as well, that had to set up an organisation for cooperative studies in Ireland. But the credit union has been a great success.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.